Santa Barbara, and across the globe at kpfk.org.
Afternoon, friends. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall, and I was hoping Jim Lafferty would be back today, my illustrious co-host, but alas, one more week to go. I know we're all really looking forward to that. In the meantime, we've got another great show planned for you today. In our first half hour, I'll be speaking with community lawyer Isabel Jurado about some of the important issues facing Angelenos as we approach the upcoming election, including in LA City Council District 14, where she'll be facing a runoff with current council member Kevin De Leon. Then, in our second half hour, I'll be joined by author and peace activist Richard Becker about the troubling escalating violence in the Middle East, and what that could mean for the U.S. and the rest of the world. And on a very quick note, let me take 30 seconds or less to thank you, our listeners, for listening. By tuning into KPFK, you are casting a vote for freedom of speech and freedom of the press, which is becoming more and more at risk, unfortunately. We hope you're out there spreading the word about the stories you hear on the Lawyers Guild Show and other programs. And, you know, because the powers that be seem to be trying to silence us. So you know what that means. We've got to turn up the volume. And if you're so moved, please turn your support up a notch of KPFK and make a donation, because it's summer fund drive time. So you can go to kpfk.org while you're listening. It's easy, and it's up to us to protect independent media. Okay, so that done. Without further ado, let's turn to our first segment. LA is a big city, but it's a very small world. And each one of us has potential to make lasting impact for the better on the community around us. Our next guest, Isabel Jurado, is an example of someone who has dedicated her career to serving others. And last year, she made her boldest decision yet to jump into local politics. She joined the race to be the next LA City Council member for District 14, the position currently occupied by Kevin De Leon. After the March primary, she was the frontrunner of seven challengers, so she'll be facing off against De Leon this November. If elected, Isabel will be the first person of Filipino descent on the council. Isabel was born and raised in LA, attended Pasadena City College, then UCLA, and then UCLA School of Law, where she earned her law degree with specializations in critical race studies and public interest law and policy. From there, she started working as a tenants' rights attorney and affordable housing activist. Most incredibly, she did it all as a single mom. Isabel Jurado, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Hi, Maria. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Sure. It's our pleasure. And of course, before I begin, I do want to let listeners know that KPFK, neither KPFK nor its hosts endorse any candidate for political office. So we will be speaking about the candidacy. So we just wanted to throw that out there. So Isabel, before we get into your decision to run for LA City Council District 14, tell us more about your local roots. What are your ties to Los Angeles?
Yes, thanks, Maria. I'm born and raised Highland Park. I'm still living in the house that I grew up in. I'm a daughter of undocumented Filipino immigrants. My mom was petitioned by her mother to come to America from the Philippines. And when she was obtaining her citizenship, she famously gave my father an ultimatum and said, if you don't come here, I'm going to go start dating this guy on the bus. And my dad was like, I can't have that. So he flew here with $1,000 in his pocket, no citizenship and got married and did all the things. And, you know, I had a pretty humble upbringing in Highland Park, surrounded by multiple titas and my two grandmas raising me in a vibrant house in Highland Park, where we were the noisy neighbors that always had a party for no reason. It seemed every weekend because, you know, life is so hard. Why not? And so that is, you know, where I came from. And from that, you know, went to school, and I guess we'll talk about that more, but that those are my roots. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, it's not like you're the only one in LA who comes from that similar background, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely something that's resonated with a lot of voters. And, you know, when you're born and raised in LA, you find, you know, a lot of Angelenos that have similar stories. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, please talk about your education. What were some of the challenges you faced in achieving that, from community college to UCLA to then law school? Did you have role models around you, or did you find that you had to blaze your own trails?
Yeah, you know, so I got pregnant when I was 18 years old, and I originally had gone to private college in San Francisco. But after I became pregnant, it was the onset of the 2008 crisis. And so, you know, half my family lost their job. I had to withdraw from four-year university. We couldn't afford it. And with a baby on the way, we really couldn't. And so that's when I really, you know, decided to enroll in community college to see it through. And I will say, you know, I've been raised by two single mothers. My grandma was one of them. She had eight children on her own. Half of whom migrated here. And my aunt, one of my aunts, you know, was a single mom. And when I was pregnant, they were the first ones to come to me and tell me that, like, you know, don't worry, we will help you, right? You have a network, a community of people that are here to support you and that you're not alone. And so I think those, you know, family members with single moms, and also just my mom and dad, you know, immigrant people are so, resilient and to make a way out of no way. And I think that really was, my inspiration and guiding light, even if maybe my, challenges were different, right? And seeing the disparity of education services between a private university and community college, one of the most glaring differences was, I remember my college counselor at four-year university was like hounding me to meet with them to schedule my classes, right? Whereas at community college, you really had to fight to schedule a meeting with your counselor, or you had to wait for hours. And so, you know, for that, just to pick the classes to make sure that you were transferring on time. And so it took a student that was agile and attentive and diligent in trying to navigate the resources to get what you needed at community college, whereas at other universities, those are just, you know, almost on a silver platter, so to speak. And so I think that's one of the major differences that I saw going to community college.
I'm just moving spaces because my little four-legged friend decided to be really loud. The joy of radio broadcasting. Okay. I wanted to talk to you about, you know, because it is the Lawyers Guild show. Did you always want to be a lawyer, or was there something in particular that sparked your idea to go to law school?
Yeah. So, you know, I had always wanted to be in social justice. My dad's challenges that he faced as an undocumented worker, where his wages were stolen, were really motivation for me to want to get involved in the labor movement. So was at the labor center, worked under Victor Naro, you know, was doing that kind of work and thinking, we need to do something else. What else can I do for my community? And being thinking like, oh, lawyers, that's another thing that we could do. And so one of the most what really did it for me was at UCLA, I did Justice Corps, which is an internship through the AmeriCorps program. It was at the LA Superior Courthouse, and we helped low-income, sometimes monolingual litigants fill out their family court paperwork. And it's either child custody, visitation, divorce. And at the time that I was doing that, personally, I was going through my own, legal case with child custody. And, with the support of my parents, we got an attorney. It was a modest one, right? But, by providing these direct services to litigants who were low income or monolingual, I remember one person who was in the same shoes that I was, right? But for these access issues, they were not able to see their right to see their children, right? And that really struck me. And sometimes even folks that knew English, because of the way the law is structured, they didn't even understand what they were doing, right? Like, divorce is the colloquial term. It's a dissolution of marriage in the legal concept. And so they're like, well, dissolution? I just want a divorce. And so from that point, I realized that the law is actually just another language, right? And if I could be a translator for folks that come from, different backgrounds to help them leverage the law for their own benefit, then that was something I wanted to do. And, I didn't know what kind of law I wanted to practice. I tried different things. I was like in the state and workers' comp, but it was really at the, at the Justice Corps, the self-help center at Stanley Mosque, where I realized the community I wanted to serve. And that has always been the driving force. And then from there was like, what schools do public interest? And then it was like, what schools? So I applied to all of those and UCLA. And then I also did I applied to a lot of these pre-law diversity programs because I had nobody in my life that was an attorney here in America. My aunt tried to pass the bar after being an attorney in the Philippines, but she couldn't, and then just like became a paralegal. And so I did the Munger, Tolles, and Olson. At the time, they had a fellows program, and we were the inaugural class, and they paid for, my LSAT training, and I had a community of peers from people like me that were, first gen going to law school. And so with that, was able to have a community of support and more confidence and advice, really, through the law school application process, because going through it and the finances of it, like that's really, like I took a break between undergrad and law school because of the money and a lot of imposter syndrome. And so having big time attorneys who had been through the process and who came from beginnings like me to advise me on like how to negotiate it and like leverage it. And I was like, I didn't even know I was in a position to do that, or like acquiring all the fee waivers to apply. It was really helpful for me to really, launch into applying to law school after years of delaying and doubting.
Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that it's almost as if you couldn't have planned it, because these extra benefits and support seem to happen after you kind of dove in. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I was so doubtful, but totally curious. So wherever I was and I met a new attorney, I was like, what, you want to have coffee? What do you do? What kind of law do you do? And then just like trying to navigate the whole thing. And eventually people were like, Isabel, she wants to go to law school. You should talk to her because she's going to talk to you about it. but it was just like, curiosity and seeing like what I could do. And for me, it was a little bit of survival, right? When I had my daughter after graduating from UCLA with my undergrad degree in poli-sci, I was like, what career can I have as a single mom that will be enough for me and my kid? Of course, I did public interest, so it was enough-ish. But, still, I was still trying to look forward to, like, how can I be self-sufficient and be the provider for my family while still doing good in this world and helping others.
Wow. Well, what about then, let's segue into running for political office. Was it something you always wanted to do, from when you were a child? Or was there something in particular along the way that you said, I'm just going to, again, dive right in head first?
No, I did dive in head first. Because I never thought I'd run for office. Like, being this front-facing woman has never been my That's not where I'm most comfortable. I like to read a lot of books. I like to think, I like policy is what really, really is exciting to me. And so all of this is really new and not something I had dreamed of. I was always like, if I ever was to be in government, I always imagined myself to be the background character, like background person, making things happen, but not being the front face. And so, you know, I'd worked in government a decade ago in the mayor's office, and that's where I learned local government 101. I learned all the departments, I learned the structure of them, how something passes through council, is executed, how city council and mayor, the relationship. It was so informative to me, but also had left that experience extremely jaded and went to law school, escaped, and stayed doing community work. I was like, I'm never going back inside the building. And then, of course, the infamous tapes come out, and I am just frustrated, right, and angered. And from anger, I, you know, for me, often anger translates into service somehow, right? And so for me, it was a deep love for my city and for my community to think like, you know what, I'm going to run in this race. I'm going to stick to my values. Look, we're running up against all these elected officials in the Democratic establishment. Like, they're not supporting us. So let's just stay true to who we are and run this. And if we're successful, then we know it's our time. But if we're not, then it just isn't. And so that's really how I went into this race, not expecting us to come out the way that we, you know, I was hopeful, but I didn't think this is going to be the outcome. And so every day is I'm in awe of what we've accomplished and what continues to do. Because then it just speaks to where people are at and what time it is. And, you know, timing really matters, right? Coming off of the heels of the historic wins of other progressives like Nidia Ramon, Ulises Hernandez, and Hugo Soto Martinez, and Kenneth Controller Mejia, and me coming on the heels of that with other folks, I think is, you know, timing played a huge part to it.
Yeah, I think that's much of life, right? and for our listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show, and I'm your co-host, Maria Hall. This is KPFK 90.7 FM. I've been speaking this half hour with Isabel Jurado, a candidate for LA City Council District 14. And as I stated at the top of the hour, KPFK does not endorse any political candidate, but it is exceptionally interesting to speak with Isabel. As I also stated at the top of the hour, it's KPFK's Summer Fun Drive. Are you a member yet? If not, it's the perfect time to join. A donation of $25 or more clinches that membership. And if you're already a member, then consider turning up your support a notch by giving a little bit more. The fate of KPFK and freedom of the press here on our radio airwaves depends on you and me. Okay, my next question, Isabel Jurado, why did you decide to run for City Council District 14 in particular, and what potential do you see there?
You know, District 14 is one that near and dear to my heart. Like I mentioned, I'm still living in the house that I grew up in. This is where, you know, we've been partying since 1989. I'm living in the house where my mom passed away, my grandma passed away. I'm so deeply rooted in this community, and this community that honestly, when push came to shove, showed up for me, right? When I was going to school and working, trying to go to UCLA to become somebody, it was my neighbors who watched my daughter when my family couldn't, right? They're the ones that welcome us in and take care of one another. And so really that deep commitment for my community. And frankly, of all the council members that I've known that have run this district, they really run it down to the ground, right? We've been run by men who use the seat for their personal gain. We have disbarred attorneys. You know, we have, you know, a council member that moved in and then like moved in the middle of their term to for higher pasture. And then we had the council member who was beloved, like homegrown, and then turns out, you know, they're sentenced to 13 years for bribery and corruption. And now we have a sitting council member who is caught being racist and bigot on tape, actively gerrymandering districts for their personal benefit, right? And so just like any other constituent in this district, we're just sick and tired of this going on. And then also in city council generally, we have had four council members indicted for corruption. And just thinking like, as an eviction defense attorney, as a person with my upbringing as a daughter of undocumented immigrants and former teen mom, it just was like, we work so hard to get even a modest amount of stability. And here are these folks running this district and our city into the ground. It's just baffling to me. And so really running because we need this honest, genuine, real people in government who are centered in our community. And for CD14, I see so much promise and opportunity, right? It's one of the richest districts in the richest city in the richest country in the world, right? We have downtown LA, which is a huge opportunity, but facing a foreclosure crisis with businesses moving out, with residents moving out. And yet we have the onset of big global events that are centered down there, whether it's FIFA or the Olympics, and yet folks don't feel safe. Our transit is disconnected. Our unhoused community continues to not be cared for, even though they've been represented by this man for over 20 years. And so I think for me, it's just baffling to think that this is such a missed opportunity to really invest in solutions, whether it's housing and homelessness, whether it's public transit, whether it's even, recreation and parks, and making sure that we have more than what, 9 public restrooms in the city of LA. I think, we, because this district has a lot of discretionary funds, we're able to pilot programs and test what works. And we need bold leadership, folks that are willing to try new things, make mistakes, and improve on it. In order to better serve the city of LA. And so I just think there's just it's all horizon for me from here. Yeah.
Wow. Well, this next question, then, you probably see potential problems as challenges that are just waiting for solutions. So what kind of challenges do you foresee in the next 5 years for the people in CD14, as well as the rest of the LA region? And I'm particularly thinking about preparing for the 2028 Olympics, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, the Olympics, Olympic fever is here. And you think about what's going to happen. I mean, we definitely want Snoop Dogg to narrate a lot of what's going on. He is our homegrown hero as well. Shout out to Snoop for all his hard work that he's been doing. Also Flava Flav, respect. But, the challenges that we see in the next 5 years are nothing that's different, right? But with the onset of the Olympics, right, thinking about how this is a huge opportunity to leverage public funds to solve our most pressing issues. We do not want to repeat the same mistakes from 1984 in which we swept up people in order to make LA more attractive and amenable to tourists and guests, right? And so fighting against displacement and housing our unhoused community and leveraging extra funds in order to do that in an expedient manner without tossing away human lives is so key to what I would want to do to prepare for the Olympics, right? And then the second thing is this is a huge opportunity for us to improve our public transit system and rehab our convention center so that we can actually accommodate all these people. This is a world-class event. We need to make sure that people can get around easily without, get to the airport, to downtown. Like, that would be a dream if we could do it on public transit, right? All the way through. And also making sure that, people are safe as we do it. And the more people that come, the safer we'll be. And the other things that I'm thinking about in terms of the 2028 Olympics is just our emergency response system. Like, if you would having enough ambulances, having enough firefighters to accommodate something that huge is so important for us to be able to put on a safe event. And so wanting to make sure that we support our city services so that we can get there and have, a great Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, we're all putting our seatbelts on. And speaking of our seatbelts on, this roller coaster of this election year has people feeling it's the best of times and worst of times.
Right.
But you do seem to feel, or you exude enthusiasm and optimism. So what advice do you have for listeners who may be in need of some inspiration and maybe are struggling with some of that imposter syndrome that you mentioned as well? You know, how can listeners, you know, what is some advice that you've earned that you can share with us to do more or to better express ourselves or, you know, do what we can to make the world better?
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. Thank you, Maria. Soft question. You know, I exude enthusiasm, yes. But also, you know, I'm incredibly skeptical and cynical too, and still to even in this position am facing imposter syndrome. And it's really tough. I don't know if, you know, I want to talk to someone and say, when did you overcome that? And they're like, I turned 50. and I was like, oh, okay, now you know who you are. But you
and
know,
it still comes back, by the
it
way.
Still yeah, comes, it still comes, yeah.
It's forever.
And it's just like, we're all, you know, I'm just trying to think like, oh, we're all just babies, you know, trying something for the first time and having to normalize it. But I think for me, in this time where things are stressful, we're 90 days out, the global news, presidential election has been yo-yoing up in town, like all of these things are going on. I go back to one of the things that I heard while I was on the campaign trail from one of, you know, my former clients who is a reclaimer. And she's a mom, she's a wife, she's a student, you know, she's learning, but she's also a teacher's aide, a union member. And, you know, when she was trying to figure out why she, motivation for reclaiming the houses in El Sereno that were vacant by Caltrans, you know, she focused on her why. And this has never left me. I think about it every single day. You know, and even, you know, get verklempt thinking about it because it was just so sincere and honest. And she was talking about how, you know, for her, she has three kids and her husband, and, you know, they wanted a bedroom, they wanted a living room, they wanted a yard, they wanted space for their family to grow and love one another and have rooms for themselves, just like what she had grown up with. And I feel the same way, right? And she said something so simple is like, she was like, I just dared to dream, right? And what she was dreaming of, when you say it out loud, it seems so simple. And it's like the bare minimum of what people should be having and giving. And when we look around, we know that there's enough for all of us, and yet there isn't. And this is the dream. And so for me, you know, I dared to dream. And folks that are like, you know, in different spaces in their life, they dare to dream for something bigger than their reality. And, you know, even if you have that fear, being brave enough to just do it anyways, right? Because at some point, maybe the circumstances will change and your dream will become a reality. I mean, I didn't even dare to dream that we'd win in this kind of way. And yet here we are, right? But you can find co-conspirators in that dream to make something a reality for you that may be even better than you imagine. So that's what I have to say.
Oh, no, that absolutely, that was beautiful and totally unplanned. But disclaimer, I am an attorney of record on one of the reclaimers lawsuits.
So, oh my God. Oh, perfect. And, yes.
Totally
very lawyerly. Very lawyerly.
Yes, yes, exactly. So yeah, we'll have to touch base on that later. But yeah, it's all good. And so, wow, we're already at the end of our half hour. Where can listeners find out more about you and your story?
You can find out more at our website, isabelgerardo.la. That's YSABELGERADO.LA. We are by the same, you know, username on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, maybe X. I don't know all of these things, but it's Isabel Gerardo LA. And you can find out more about us through there.
Yes, and it is JURADO, by the way, for our listeners. And thank you so much again, community lawyer Isabel Hurado, for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Maria. Thank you, KPFK. You all are the best.
All right. Well, thanks to our listeners. And we are, one last reminder, KPFK does not endorse any political candidate. We just have great news and interesting stories to tell you about. And then we never want to tell you how to vote. You make up your own mind. That's what we believe in. That's how we roll here at KPFK. And normally we take a very quick 30-second ID break here, but instead I'm just going to talk through it because it is Summer Fun Drive here on KPFK. So I want to challenge you to take this 30 seconds to pause, take a look around. What can you do right here, right now to make a difference, to improve our world? Well, we hope that by listening to KPFK, you will be inspired to share these diverse perspectives that you're hearing on the station, and also hope that you will be inspired to become a member for a donation of $25 or more. If you're already a member, of course, well, you know how critical these funds are to keep KPFK loud and strong on the airwaves. So give a little more. As you know, KPFK doesn't sell corporate advertising and doesn't even take taxpayer money. A lot of people don't realize that. We rely on listeners like you and like me. I've already made my pledge, so please take a minute and go to kpfk.org and make yours too. Or if you like the phone, you can call 818-985-5735. Okay, back to the show. Again, this is the Lawyers Guild Show, KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall. I thought my co-host, Jim Lafferty, would be back today, but he will be back next week. Promise. Okay, so we turn now from our local community in LA to the Middle East. Much of the world is now on edge, fearing a wider regional war in the Middle East as a result of Israel's recent assassinations in Lebanon and Iran, which killed senior Hamas and Hezbollah figures, and Israel's increasing military actions against the Houthis in Yemen. Iran has promised to respond with major force against Israel over the assassinations that took place on its soil. And Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen are gearing up for a wider war as well. The U.S. has already said it will defend Israel from any new attacks, and it's already ordered additional aircraft, warships, and military personnel to the Middle East and closer to the coast of Israel. So, will the Israeli-Palestinian war widen further into a full-scale regional war? And if it does, will the U.S. be drawn deeper and deeper into it? What will these developments mean for the chances of a ceasefire and the desperate and growing humanitarian crisis already faced by the civilian population of Palestine? Well, to help us answer these and other questions, we're fortunate to have our guest today, Richard Becker. Mr. Becker is the author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, and is the West Coast coordinator of the National Peace and Social Justice Organization, ANSWER Coalition. ANSWER, if you remember, is an acronym for, quote, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. And the coalition has sponsored the largest national protests against the U.S. wars in Iraq and in the Middle East. Richard Becker, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks very much, Maria. I appreciate it.
Yes, yes. So jumping right in, Israel's war in Palestine has lasted many months now and has already widened into Iran, Lebanon, and beyond. Diplomats and others are worried it could become a full-scale regional war. Can you explain for our listeners what has happened in the last several days that's led the world to be increasingly fearful of a full-blown regional war in the Middle East?
Well, the Netanyahu administration, Netanyahu being, of course, the prime minister of Israel, has continued to say that it's in favor of some kind of a ceasefire, but takes action to make sure that there's no possibility of that happening. So it was just a little over a week ago, 10 days ago, that on the same day, two leading officials, one from Hezbollah in Lebanon, who was called chief of staff or military commander, was assassinated by drone, by Israeli drone. And then within the same 24-hour period, Ismail Haniyeh, who was the head of the Politburo of Hamas, and who was the top official in Hamas, was assassinated apparently by a bomb placed in a house that he was staying in Tehran, Iran. And he was there for the inauguration of the new president. So these are clearly the most provocative kind of actions that could possibly be taken. And it makes clear that the intention of the Netanyahu government is not to have peace, they're not to have any kind of ceasefire agreement, but to continue the war. And really, they are daring the forces of resistance in the region to do anything. And then they promised that would be followed by doing to them what they've done to Gaza already. So it's and you know the tremendous there's a tremendous irony, I mean a bitter irony, that you have them do this, and then what does the U.S. government, which is supposedly in favor of a ceasefire, what do? They proclaim that yes, if a new wider war happens, they'll be weighing in on the side of Israel. Not that that's any surprise, but the fact that it would come as an announcement subsequent to the assassinations is really something quite remarkable. And I think for people in the United States, we should reject this. This is the actions of the U.S. government are making possible the genocide that's being carried out by the state of Israel in Gaza and the other wars that it's carrying out in the region.
And I do want to ask you about the US in just a minute, but I wanted to take a sideway turn for one moment to talk about Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu in particular and their elections. So I can't help but wonder to what extent Netanyahu's military actions in Iran and beyond are related to his desire to maybe distract from Israel's elections or just expand the war in order to postpone Israel's elections. Can you talk a little bit about that and about his approval ratings and what would happen if he is ousted?
Yeah, it's very interesting because before these assassinations, it looked as if there were an election held that Netanyahu's coalition would lose the election. But that's changed. Assassinations and war are what create consensus in the state of Israel. And so there were all kinds of congratulatory messages to Netanyahu in response to the assassinations that were carried out. This was great, including there was one group of the captured people, the hostages' families, saying, "Yes, keep killing the leaders of Hamas." Well, if you want to have any possibility of the hostages being freed, they can't continue that path. But again, this is. It really is what unites Israel is the wars, the interventions, the assassinations. And I mean, it's a highly militarized state. That if we look at it historically, it was at war in 1948 and 49. It was at a war again in 1953, in 1956, in 1967, in 1982. And then the subsequent, the wars against war after war against Gaza, Operation Cast Lead. They have all these names for them, but it's a warfare state, but it's enabled to go about doing what it does because of its relationship with the United States.
And speaking with the United States, it does seem that the mainstream news has been covering the presidential elections. And might that distraction give Netanyahu a little bit of cover for this increased military aggression?
Yes, it does give him increased cover if he needs any. I think that what we're seeing is that it maybe doesn't need any. You know, there was a period of time in 2008 when Barack Obama was elected. Between the time of the Obama election and inauguration, there was a huge assault. I think it was called Operation Cast Lead on Gaza, and it ended just before the inauguration. There was the same kind of thing that happened then in 2008 between the election in 2008 and inauguration in early 2009. So we see this pattern that any kind of thing that's going on inside the U.S., which can be as a distraction, as you put it, you know, Israel's made use of that many times, but now it doesn't appear to be that they really need it. And it's really something that, despite the disagreements, supposedly, when push comes to shove, the U.S. says, whatever Israel does, whatever acts of terror or genocide it carries out, we will support Israel.
Well, and as a follow-up, former Israeli diplomat Alan Pincus has wondered in the Haaretz newspaper in Israel why Netanyahu chose this moment to assassinate a Hamas leader in Iran, given that the parties were engaged in delicate hostage negotiations and ceasefire talks. You've alluded a little bit to the elections, but what are your other thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, one part of it is that Netanyahu wishes the war to continue because then he doesn't have to deal with the legal issues, the crimes that he's accused of, and so on and so forth. But I think that there's something more to it than that, and that really this makes clear that Israel has no interest in any kind of an agreement, any kind of a ceasefire. From Netanyahu's point of view, if he can get the population mainly behind him, then he doesn't have to worry about the hostages or the hostage families, and he's done that. So, I think that there are a lot of differences inside of Israeli society over things like who has to serve in the army, and whether or not there's a priority for getting the hostages free, or what kind of government is Israel going to have this, continue to have this extreme right-wing government that has had now for almost 2 years. And I think that all of those, the Pincus analysis of it, Alan Pincus from the liberal Zionist newspaper Haaretz, addresses those as, you know, saying there's something bigger that's going on here, and I think he's right.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall. I'm speaking this half hour with peace and justice activist Richard Becker about the prospect of escalating military aggression in the Middle East. And just as a reminder, you won't hear in-depth and thoughtful interviews with guests like Richard Becker on Main Street Corporate Media, so it is KPFK's summer fund drive time. Go to kpfk.org and make sure that your membership is up to date. Richard Becker, a number of military experts have predicted Israel would not fare so well if they must fight against not only Hamas in Palestine, but also in Iran, Lebanon, and Yemen. Do you agree? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it's always very difficult to say what will happen in a war. And Israel, in terms of having the most modern military equipment and vast amounts of it provided by the U.S., but also, you know, Germany and Britain, France, some others, us, South Korea, saw weapons, but and they make some of their own. So they're it's an extremely heavily armed country and able to inflict great damage on neighboring countries and even countries that are pretty far away. So this is something that has to be taken into account by the leaders of Hezbollah and Iran and the Houthi Ansar Allah in Yemen and others in the region who are part of the Axis of Resistance, fighting against imperialist and Israeli domination. So what Israel, I think, has been doing, what Netanyahu has been kind of hanging on to, is the idea that can do these things, can humiliate these countries. I mean, to murder Ismail Haniyeh in Iran is a violation, of course, of Iran's sovereignty, as well as an act of terror. But you know, they're doing this, they're carrying it out, and kind of, I think, waging the future on the idea that no one's going to really react in a big way to it, and so they can humiliate other countries. They clearly, the attacks that took place in Iran and in Lebanon, the assassinations we were talking about of the Hezbollah leader and the Hamas leader, respectively, they were meant to humiliate and weaken those organizations and countries by making them appear to be weak. And then what Israel is saying, you know, so if you respond in a big way, then we'll carry out massive bombing of the southern part of Beirut, and densely populated areas of other countries. So I think that's what they're what their strategic thinking is about this. And by so doing, by carrying this out, as I said before, unites a considerable part, not all, but a considerable part of the Israeli population behind them.
Well, Richard Becker, as I mentioned in my introduction to this topic, the Biden-Harris administration has already sent more military force and personnel to the Middle East. And the administration has made it clear by its comments and its actions that if Israel does find itself in a region-wide war, the U.S. will continue supporting Israel. Do you think the U.S. is bluffing? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, they've deployed another aircraft carrier in the region. They've sent other squadrons of war planes there. I think that if Israel were to appear to be in trouble or losing a war, that the U.S. would certainly intervene. I mean, we would have to believe that they would intervene. And maybe they will intervene without that being a possibility as well. So the military, Israel is a military state, but the U.S. is a military state too. I mean, war after war after war. And actually the generals, the people at the top in the military, like to take the opportunity to engage in warfare. They feel that it makes their troops more, you know, combat ready for other wars and other interventions that'll take place. So I think that if a big war breaks out, that it's very likely that the U.S. will directly intervene in the war.
So if the Israeli-Palestinian war does become a region-wide war in the Middle East, and let's say the U.S. does join Israel's side in such a war, what do you think would be its likely impact on the presidential election here in the U.S., if any?
I think it'll have some impact, but we don't really know how. I mean, if there's a serious war, I think both Trump and Harris are going to support Israel. I think regardless of their whatever criticisms Trump has had, or you know, saying, oh, I could have ended this war in a day, or whatever the different things that he says. The U.S. ruling class, and the parties of the U.S. ruling class, the Democrats and the Republicans, have always been able to unite when it came to war. I mean, at the beginning of the Vietnam War, of the mass deployment of U.S. troops to Vietnam in 1965, that followed the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which was a falsified incident that had not happened. Supposedly North Vietnam had attacked a U.S. destroyer with a patrol boat or something like that. But the vote was 98-2 in the Senate for doing it. The two senators from Alaska declined to vote for it. But, you know, that's unusual. Like when the Patriot Act passed, which was really a document of war and repression, one person in the House of Representatives, Shirley Lee, I mean, not Shirley Lee, Barbara Lee voted against it. She's the only one who did. So there's usually, especially at the beginning of war, if the war becomes a losing proposition, like when Vietnam became a losing proposition, then there was growing opposition and growing opposition actually in both the Democratic and Republican parties. But as long as they have the propaganda machine in motion and persuading most of the population that this is a war that's of necessity rather than a war of choice, they can hope to, you know, to hold on to. And both of them, I think that both of them, as I said, would support intervention, particularly if a war starts and is going badly for Israel.
And speaking of the propaganda machine, I'm curious as to your thoughts back in, you know, I remember the Answer Coalition's humongous protests against the war in Iraq and then Afghanistan. Is there a difference now with, you know, with AI and deep fakes and social media? How is that playing out in organizing and in, you know, trying to get alternative voices out there?
Well, there's a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of platforms, a lot of ways to get the message out. It's a different situation than with Iraq in that at this point, there's not the deployment of U.S. troops, or at least publicly so. In the both of the Iraq wars, the 1991 war and the 2003 war, there were large deployments. Like in the first one, the U.S. deployed 525,000 U.S. troops to the Middle East. I mean, this was against a country that was a developing country, a poor developing country. And it wasn't quite that many in the second Gulf War, or the second war against Iraq, which was called shock and awe, which started with, you know, massive air attack and then the occupation of Iraq. And it became a puppet government was put into place. But both of those were made different than probably what would happen right now, is that the huge deployment of U.S. troops also has a big impact on public opinion inside the United States in terms of anti-war sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard Becker, we are running out of time. What are your last thoughts about, you know, both the increasing, the escalating tensions and war in the Israeli-Palestinian war, and also in a region-wide war if that does in fact materialize?
Well, I think it's very, very important. The most important thing is we don't have much control over that, what's going happening at the top. But we do have the capacity to mobilize. Hundreds of thousands of people have joined demonstrations. It was 10 months ago today, actually, that the current war started and the current genocide started. We've seen huge demonstrations. They have not been as numerous lately, but that's completely expectable. I mean, in the Vietnam War period, the numbers and demonstrations did not go up. We have to do what we can do. And this is what's really important, is that people continue the organizing in neighborhoods. There's been big advances in the anti-war organizing in the labor movement, particularly inside the UAW and teachers' unions and other unions. We have to keep doing that. Building a mass movement is not easy. It takes determination. It takes persistence. But it's the most important thing we can do. That is what we have control over. The listeners who are listening today, there and around the country who are listening to KPFK, I would just encourage everyone to be steadfast. There's a word that a lot of us have learned in the recent months, and it's sumud, which means steadfastness in Arabic. And the Palestinian people have been steadfast in their resistance, and other people in the Middle East. And we need to be steadfast in building this powerful, strong, numerous a movement as we possibly can.
Well, thank you so much, Richard Becker, for joining us here on the Lawyers Guild Show today. Where can listeners learn more about your work and about you?
Well, they can find it, the new edition of our book, which was just republished this year, Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, at 1804books.com. 1804 Books, the 1804 is a reference to the Haitian Revolution. And that's connected to the People's Forum in New York, so they can get the book there. And also, people can get a lot more information at answercoalition.org, answercoalition.org.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being with us again. We always appreciate you and hope to have you back on soon.
Thank you.
Sure. All right. Well, before we end today's show, I wanted to remind you one last time that it's KPFK's Fun Drive time, Summer Fun Drive. If you enjoyed the great conversations you heard today, please visit kpfk.org to give a little something back. You can call us also if you prefer speaking with a human at 818-985-5735. If you're online, be sure to click that box that says you're listening to The Lawyers Guild Show, because we really love to know that you're listening. And, you know, it's been 65 years. I was about to say 45, 65 years that KPFK has been bringing independent voices, diverse perspectives, great music and cultural programming that are curated and brought to you in one free place. There's no subscription fee like other platforms. KPFK doesn't take big corporate ad dollars. It really operates on a shoestring budget. It is a labor of love, leveraging dollars from listeners like you and me with countless volunteer hours. It's truly listener-sponsored and critical. It's critical for us to keep KPFK free, to be the voice that speaks truth to power and celebrates various, many, many cultures and viewpoints. That's the difference between some of the powers that be out there that want to silence KPFK, as well as other, what they perceive to be independent airwaves. That means we need to turn up our volume. That means that we must speak louder than ever before to keep free speech free, keep freedom of the press strong. We need it for our society and for future generations. So please go on kpfk.org. Even a $25 gift is amazing, and that gives you member status. And if you give a little more, awesome. There are a couple of thank you gifts on there, just a little something that KPFK says thank you, like a tote bag with the proud KPFK logo on it. So you can bring that tote bag with you and find other KPFK members to talk to and, you know, be fast friends. So, like I said, kpfk.org, let them know you're listening to The Lawyers Guild Show. And that is just about all for today. It always goes by so fast. So in closing, I want to again thank today's guests, Isabel Hirado and Richard Becker, as well as Bordoff, D'Angelo Jones, my co-host Jim Lafferty, who will be back next week, I promise, and everyone out there at KPFK volunteering and listening. Until next week, this is Maria Hall with The Lawyers Guild Show. Get up, stand up.
Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, oh, tell me, heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know.
Thank you for tuning in to KPFK, your listener-sponsored radio station. This week, we'll be wrapping up our fun drive, so time is running out for us to reach our goal and cover our expenses. If you haven't already, please make your pledge now to help KPFK continue providing important, fact-based journalism without corporate influence. You can do that at kpfk.org/donate or by calling 818-985-5735 to make a contribution. KPFK has been addressing the world's most critical issues since 1959. So if you're passionate about humanity and this planet, please donate at any level you can. Every contribution counts, whether it's a one-time gift or a monthly installment. Once more, please visit kpfk.org/donate or call us at 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK.
Art Podell, co-host of Roots Music and Beyond, here at KPFK, inviting you to a celebration of folk music. August 17th and 18th, live at the Greek Theater, performing art.